Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. 21 pages, 82 footnotes from Donald Trump today, a speech entitled "An America First Economic Plan Winning the Global Competition." From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. The 8th of August today, Monday, great as always to have you along, everybody. Dateline Detroit, the economic club thereof, a speech by the Republican nominee for President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. A speech nominally about economic policy specifics, bits of which we will be hearing throughout the program today, by the way. But it was, in reality, a speech built around an economic policy ideal.
It will be American workers who are hired to do the job. American workers. Americanism, not globalism, will be our new credo.
It's not the first time Mr. Trump has used that phrase, Americanism, not globalism, but it does seem to be a newly clear foundation for his economic policies. What is less clear is how he's going to get there. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams starts us off.
It wasn't by accident Donald Trump chose to give this speech in Detroit.
American cars will travel the roads. American steel will send new skyscrapers soaring all over our country.
Voters may think of Trump as residing in the top of those skyscrapers, but running mate Mike Pence pointed out Trump's background gives him a more nuanced view of the economy.
Even as he has built skyscrapers to the sky, he's never forgotten the men and women who work with their hands. In a very real sense, he has been a builder who has built alongside the men and women who have done the work.
This is the new Trump doctrine, not globalism, but Americanism. It's a message that could strike a chord among people who haven't fared as well in the slow economic recovery. The question, though, is how would he make it happen? Larry Michel of the Center-Left Economic Policy Institute says on that front, Trump didn't offer anything new.
Donald Trump on trade treaties claims that he can renegotiate them and get different outcomes. He has never said exactly what he is going to try to do.
And for Douglas Holtz Aiken at the center-right American Action Forum, what stood out was what wasn't in Trump's speech.
He didn't say a word about debt. He didn't say a word about deficits or any of the financial problems of the federal government. He was quiet about the minimum wage. No real mention of entitlement reform and spending issues.
In many ways, today's speech presented a new frame for Trump's economic policies, but it's clear there are a lot of details left to be sketched out inside that frame. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Continuing now with things Donald Trump said today, after a riff on tax and trade and energy policies, he said this.
We can use this new wealth to rebuild our military, which is desperately needed, and our infrastructure.
Delta Airlines passengers are open, that's true, the infrastructure bit anyway. About 450 flights were canceled and tens of thousands more delayed by a massive power outage at the airline's Atlanta hub. Delta is not alone, of course, with its infrastructure woes. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more now on what's up with the airline industry.
Jonathan Bunch called me from Denver National Airport.
I'm on the plane right now, but we just haven't left yet. We're still on the tarmac.
He's finally on the plane to Atlanta for a layover about 7 hours after his flight was originally supposed to take off.
You could tell that something was amiss because at every gate, people were lined up.
People couldn't access their electronic tickets because systems were down.
The day's not over for me. I'm not optimistic that I will get out of Atlanta smoothly.
This kind of system meltdown is not unique to Delta.
Three of the four largest carriers in the U.S. have gone through this now.
George Hamlin is president of Hamlin Transportation Consulting.
Different reasons, different times, and they're not necessarily connected.
It's tempting to look at airlines' basic computer systems, which are, well, they're old.
Airlines work with a variety of systems, some of which are based on 1950s architecture.
Robert Mann is president of R.W. Mann and Company, but around that basic framework has grown a massive network of often state-of-the-art systems.
It's a hybrid.
And for most airlines, the old computer systems themselves have worked pretty well. The vulnerability, Mann says, comes from the fact that IT networks and systems built up around them are so numerous and complex. And as airlines merge and offer more options to passengers, the complexity grows.
Network failures are just a function of many, many, many and increasing numbers of network devices in use. You lose reliability when the weakest link in the chain is broken.
Delta's on-time performance had been far and ahead of much of the competition, and its network technology is actually in better shape than that of carriers like Southwest. It seems to have been undone by something comparatively old-fashioned. A simple power switch malfunctioned. Mann says probably while they were testing it out. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Sadly, no good Trump quote for the markets today, but we will have the details when we do the numbers. Jobs were the subtext of a lot of what Mr. Trump was talking about today.
I am proposing an across-the-board income tax reduction, especially for middle-income Americans. This will lead to millions of new and really good-paying jobs.
There was on Twitter this weekend sort of a social media corollary to the politics of the day. The hashtag First Seven Jobs was hot, in which, just like it sounds, you list your first seven jobs. Astronaut Buzz Aldrin, late-night host Stephen Colbert, actress Mira Sorvino, and many, many more, known and un, shared their first jobs with the world. It was a meme that struck a chord, fittingly enough, perhaps, because it was started by a singer-songwriter up in Juneau, Alaska, named Marion Call. Marion, it's good to have you on.
Hi, Kai.
So there you are last week, noodling around with this new song you wanted to write, and you get this idea about first seven jobs. Tell me how you got there.
I'm writing a song about work. It might sound funny, but I don't like to write songs about love and romance so much. I feel that's been done. So I write about other things, like spaceships and avocados, and our relationship to work is what interests me right now. I always ask Twitter when I need songwriting ideas, so I just volunteered my first few jobs and asked other people what theirs were. And apparently I struck a nerve.
You totally did. When did you know you had something special going on here?
Not until the next day. I have a lot of friends on Twitter who are in Europe, and I saw them as I'm going to sleep in Alaska starting to answer at a rapid pace, you know, maybe 20, 30, 40 per hour. I woke up in the morning and it was 20 or 30 or 40 per minute.
You have had some awesome people responding to this. Which ones struck you? Which ones made you say, oh, wow, look at that?
Oh, there have been a lot of famous actors and entertainers, but I got to say Buzz Aldrin was the top for me.
Buzz Aldrin, second man on the moon. That's a good one. I have to look him up. What did he say? He probably said, like, astronaut and something else, right?
Well, he did say astronaut, but I was a little jealous that his fourth job was astronaut. I mean, I think he started dishwashing like a lot of us, but yeah. He got there pretty quick. I don't think I became a full-time musician for maybe my first 25 or 30 jobs.
Oh, you see, that's so interesting, because when I did this yesterday, I got to seven and then I ran out. This job is my seventh job, and I don't know if
what was your first?
I mowed lawns when I was a kid, and then I got a job as doing like painting and maintenance for the school district. And then it kind of went from there. But it's funny how it makes you think about sort of the stops your career has made along the way, if you will.
Well, and your relationship to work as a person. I like this hashtag because it's really individual. It's about each person's little tiny journey, and you get to see thousands of strangers reflecting on that journey and about what all those meant. Like, you, some jobs you were good at, some jobs you hated, yeah. Some jobs you learned what it was like to have a bad boss, or you learned what it was like to have a great boss or be your own boss.
Right. This song, then, I think, is going to turn out to be maybe about something other than work, or something more deep about work, maybe.
I think more about what we have in common about work, about our human relationship to work. They're surprisingly fun to read, although I also find they're really shockingly personal. Like, you get a picture of a human behind each one, but I kind of like it.
Huh. Now that you have all this data on this topic that you want to write about, when do we get to hear the song?
No promises on that. I've been writing songs too long to promise a date. But I'm working on a big record project now and probably after that. It's surprisingly hard to hoover up all the information, though, in any way. I'm still looking for the exact tool that will let me filter all these results and see what we got.
Well, as great as Twitter is, I imagine you now have more data on this particular song than you can use.
Yeah, but there's something great about seeing data in the aggregate like that, which is part of why I love Twitter. I mean, all the little voices are just as important as the big voices. All my, people with 20 or 30 followers all the way around the world are telling me information with the same presentation and the same framing as when Stephen Colbert does it.
Mm-hmm. No, that is totally true. Marion Call is her name. The song is as yet to be titled, but the hashtag is First Seven Jobs. If you got one that you want to put out, a list that you want to put out, hit us up on Twitter and we'll get it around. Marion, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Kai.
That bridge, by the way, that was the Avocado Song by Marion Call. All right, moving on. Simplicity, you could say, was the theme of Mr. Trump's remarks today. Fewer government regulations and a simplified tax code as well.
My plan will reduce the current number of brackets from 7 to 3 and dramatically streamline the process.
Simplicity and streamlining are also sort of the theme of today's installment of our series, I've Always Wondered. Your questions, our answers about this or that bewildering topic in business and the economy. Today, a trip to the dark underbelly of telephone customer service, something called interactive voice response. Typically, as you know, these questions come from listeners, but this one is from Marketplace's Sally Herships. Why, when calling companies, she wants to know, are you asked to enter information like account numbers or date of birth, but then you have to repeat that same information to a human operator? Since she asked the question, we made her answer it. Here's Sally.
Okay, I am about to dial my health insurance company.
Please tell me your date of birth.
February 11th, 1973.
Sorry, what date was that?
February 11th, 1973.
I'm having trouble bringing up your information.
Ugh, so frustrating. But you know who's even more frustrated? The people who design the systems.
Ugh, it drives me crazy. So painful, and it doesn't have to happen.
Janelle Matthews is with Genesis. The company designs IVRs, Interactive Voice Response Systems. She's talking about when we have to repeat information multiple times. She knows it doesn't have to be that way, but companies don't always take her advice.
It's kind of a really basic, like, customer service party foul. This technology that solves this problem was invented 25 years ago.
Matthew says it's like caller ID on an iPhone. When a friend calls, you see their picture and name pop up because all the information is linked. She says it's just as easy for companies to link the information they collect about you, but a lot just don't update their software. And there's another problem. Even when companies do have up-to-date systems, sometimes human representatives ask us to repeat information as a stall tactic. Why are they stalling?
So imagine yourself looking in front of a monitor. You're taking call after call after call.
So you have to load a lot of websites and run a lot of applications. Maybe your computer freezes. You don't want your system to seem old or out of date. So while you wait, you stall by asking for the information again. After all, maybe you're just double checking for security reasons.
Which might also be why they're double asking for it, right?
Maybe. But at this point, we might be too angry to care. Walter Rolandi also designs interactive voice response systems. He says a big problem, one designers often fail to take into account, is that customers may already be frustrated before they even dial the phone.
Consider it. When do you call a company for customer support? Something's wrong. The world became imperfect today. Your check didn't clear. Your product failed. Your phone isn't working right.
And it's likely you have already spent time trying to solve the problem on your own. So your mood can quickly go downhill, especially when faced with robo-clichés like, thank you for calling. Your call is very important to us.
Obviously, they know that's not true.
But what is true is what you might call customer service rage. Rolandi says consumers who encounter problems with automated systems can be like rats in a science lab trained to press a bar for food that suddenly stops working.
The rat will go back and hit the bar the next time he wants a piece of food, and nothing happens. And then he'll hit it again and again and again. And eventually he might attack the bar.
For the consumer, that can mean losing it. For the company, that can mean losing a customer. But Rolandi says the irony is, in the world of automated phone systems, success is measured in containment, how many customers you can prevent from getting through to a human.
Clearly, the number one motivator for companies is to, you know, avoid an agent talking to a customer.
PV Kannan is CEO of 24/7, another company that designs these automated systems. He says it's really expensive to talk to a human.
You know, an average call costs a U.S. company, you know, roughly about $5. And that's just an average call. I mean, you know, when you file a car insurance claim, it could be as much as $15 to $20.
And some companies get millions of calls a year. When you talk to a computer, it only costs a few cents. But talking to a computer can make you feel cynical.
A lot of times you get frustrated, then you say, let me talk to a supervisor. Is there really a supervisor?
There are supervisors in the call center industry. Typically, there is one supervisor for every 12 to 15 agents.
But what the companies have figured out is everybody wants to talk to a supervisor.
So the agent just puts it on pause for a couple of seconds, picks up the phone, and then pretends to be the supervisor. So,
no, really?
Yeah, it's pretty common.
So the next time you're on the phone feeling like a rat in a cage, just remember there are other people out there more frustrated than you, and they are the ones who designed the system. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Knights wanted you to believe that they were stronger, better, more powerful than ordinary human beings.
Jousting as an Olympic sport, I kid you not. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 14 points today, less than a tenth percent, 18,529. The NASDAQ down 7 points, about a tenth percent, 5213. The S&P 500 off 2 points, about a tenth percent, 2180 there. Energy stocks quickened as crude oil prices rose. Marathon Oil up 2.7%. Murphy Oil gushed up 2.3%. Walmart down about 0.5% today. The retail giant announced it's buying fast-growing online retailer Jet.com for $3 billion in cash, $300 million more in stock. Walmart wants to challenge online retailer behemoth Amazon. Amazon couldn't have cared less, off less than a 10% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. It wasn't all straight economic policy from Donald Trump today. Public safety was in there as well.
We will also give our police and law enforcement the funds and support they need to restore law and order to this country. Law and order.
Not a whole lot of law and order in Suicide Squad, Warner Brothers' new blockbuster that opened this weekend. Critics hated it. Fans loved it, though. $135 million in domestic ticket sales for the weekend open. Sales did drop by almost half on Saturday, but Marketplace's Andy Euler reports Warner Brothers is banking on folks going back to see the thing more than once.
Estimates say Suicide Squad cost more than $325 million to make and market. The opening weekend was good, but the movie will have to make a whole lot more for Warner Brothers to break even. Daniel Luria is editorial director at Box Office Media. He says a blockbuster's financial success basically comes down to two things.
Either for it to be released in China and just be a runaway success, or to have audiences here in North America absolutely fall in love with the movie and come back to see it again and again.
That repeat business is something more and more studios are banking on. Chriselle Russell teaches marketing at American University. Her research is on why we rewatch things.
You remember liking the movie? You don't remember exactly all the details. So the joy of rewatching it is rediscovering what it is about this movie that you actually enjoyed.
She says that means the movie has to live up to the marketing. But in the case of Suicide Squad, whether critics liked it or not is kind of beside the point. The fans wanted to see the comic book characters they know and love on the big screen. And Warner Brothers marketing made sure people were talking about it well in advance of the opening.
I think this is why you see all this marketing, you know, boom at the beginning. It's like they want to get all that kind of excitement and people talking about things to make you want to go see it and then go re-watch it again.
Movie marketing is following audience viewing trends. According to BoxOffice.com, users tweeted about Suicide Squad almost 650,000 times on Friday. And the positive tweets outnumbered negative ones 6-1. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We have on our website our Marketplace Superhero Sound Quiz. Take it, see if you can do better than I did, which was not that good. Marketplace.org. Just because no report on a Donald Trump speech would be complete without this line, here you go.
We are in a competition with the world, and I want America to win.
Speaking of winning, the U.S. team is doing all right so far down in Rio, but Olympic authorities are under some pressure from a British group to admit a new sporting event. Well, not so new, really. The conservation group English Heritage wants jousting to get some international love. Here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
The campaign to get jousting into the Olympics may seem rather quaint, but English Heritage has invested heavily in this medieval sport and wants it to reach a wider audience. Lucy Hutchings is the group's head of events.
It's really important for us to be able to engage with the public so they understand the incredible kind of rich history that surrounds them.
The group has hosted countless jousting events at its castles as a way of bringing history to life. But is this really suitable for a 21st century Olympics? Galloping towards your opponent at 30 miles an hour and smashing them off their horse? It all sounds, well, medieval.
The point is to break your lance on your opponent and to hit them in very specific places upon their armour. So you get different points depending on whereabouts you strike them. It's not about knocking them off their horse.
Four centuries after it peaked as the ultimate spectator sport, jousting is making a comeback. From his stables here in Northamptonshire, Dominic Sewell runs a company called Historic Equitation. Launched only a few years ago, it now turns over $2 million annually, staging jousts with richly caparisoned horses and, of course, Latter-day Knights dressed in shining armour.
This fits on the arm. You can see it's all different laminations around the elbow here.
The whole kit can weigh more than 80 pounds, so you have to be pretty fit to get on the horse and ride.
You've got to, of course, hold a 12-foot lance at the same time.
12-foot lance, exactly, which, again, at the end of the day, I still have to manoeuvre that lance at 25 miles an hour on a charging horse. So that takes skill and dedication to the craft.
Making this, says Sewell, the perfect Olympic sport. Weightlifting, fencing and dressage all rolled into one. But in a modern sea of spandex and lycra, wouldn't the jousters look out of place?
Wouldn't it be a little bizarre in the 21st century having Olympiads competing in medieval suits of armour?
Golf's currently there. Skateboarding, many other martial arts are. There's no reason why the armoured sports couldn't be either.
His horse at least seems to be raring to go, but not everyone involved in jousting is quite so gung-ho about getting it into the Olympics.
Well, welcome everybody to today's gallery talk.
Toby Capwell, curator of arms and armour at the Wallace Collection in London, takes visitors on a tour of some of his exhibits. He's not only a museum curator, but also a keen jouster. He's nervous about the campaign to make it an Olympic sport.
I worry that you would lose everything that makes it wonderful.
He can't imagine the Olympic authorities would allow people to clank around the stadium in medieval armour. He fears they'd be forced to wear Kevlar and Velcro. The colour and flamboyance of his beloved sport would be lost, detaching it from historical reality. At its peak, he says, jousting was about exaggerating physical appearance and flaunting social domination.
The joust is the proof of the rights of an aristocratic society. Superheroes are real, and they're in charge.
And he says if a bunch of medieval knights descended on a modern Olympics, another major scandal would likely ensue.
Knights wanted you to believe that they were stronger, better, more powerful than ordinary human beings. And yeah, they would have loved performance-enhancing drugs. I mean, they would have taken them by the sackful.
Jousting may have more in common with the modern Olympics than I thought. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one last line from Donald Trump's speech this afternoon.
Our party has chosen to make new history by selecting a nominee from the outside And that's outside of the very, very already proven rigged system.
Without putting too fine a point on it, there is no substantive voter fraud in this country. 31 incidents out of a billion votes cast since 2000. That's according to a study published in the Washington Post. To take it one logical step further, unfounded allegations that a national election is rigged are corrosive at best. All right, we got to go. 14 down on the Dow today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 7 points, a 10% there. The S&P 500, 2 points, about a 10%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bondner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.